All righty, let's pick it up where we left off last week. We will pick it up in on page 25 when we get there. But we're in chapter number 1. And in chapter 1, as far as the time frames go, we're sitting in the prophet's present time. I don't know exactly how long this will go, but this vision in chapter 1 all occurs, of course, in his present time during the Babylonian exile. Now, he is in Babylon, and we took a look at where he's living. This is the Euphrates River flowing down to the west and south, and then starting north of Babylon and flowing down to through the land of Nippur is the River Chebar, the Grand Canal. At least that's what most commentators think this river canal is in this area. And so this is where Tel Aviv was located. This is where Ezekiel received his call and gave all his prophecies, somewhere in the land of Babylon. And of course, remember, this is what drove the rabbis nuts, because they said that their theology says that a prophet has to be called in the land of Israel. He can minister outside the land of Israel, but he has to be called in the land of Israel. And that's not the case with Ezekiel. He was called outside the land, and he issued his prophecies outside the land. So that was one of the reasons, why the rabbis didn't want to include this book in Scripture, but eventually did after they tried to reconcile everything. Okay. What did he see while in Tel Aviv by the River Chebar? Coming from the north, he saw an enormous storm cloud. Something like glowing metal was in the midst of it, the chashmal, which had this amber kind of glow, like some metal heated in a furnace. And this huge, enormous storm cloud had lightning flashing from it, had a bright glow in the center of it. That was the overview of what he saw. So whether he saw something like this, I think it was probably much more stupendous than this sunset, or I guess this would be a sunset here. Much more stupendous than this, but still we get the idea, because here we can see an amber glow and the bright light in the clouds, the massive storm cloud there. One thing we know he was not seeing was a spaceship, right? Remember, a lot of people don't like this, and they say, oh, see, he was seeing a spaceship. That's all he was seeing, a UFO. Well, folks, if UFOs were around in Ezekiel's day, they're sure trying to stay away from us, believe me. I am firmly convinced, yeah, they look down, if they exist, which I don't believe they do, they look down on us and say, boy, those guys, well, stay away from them. Keep them on their planet. But I am firmly convinced that we are it. This little planet, this little dust speck, this little privileged planet is where the sin issue of the universe is going to be dealt with. And I am firmly convinced we are it. All our radio telescopes and satellites and trips to Mars, whatever we do, has not found anything. And I don't think we'll find anything. So God will take care of that. And when the sin issue's all wrapped up, things may change. I have a feeling things will change. I have a feeling that you and I may get to explore this vast universe that he's made. But till then, he wants to take care of that issue. So he was seeing the Shekinah glory. Remember that stated very clearly by Ezekiel. I was seeing the Shekinah glory of God, the Shekinah. Okay? Let's see. What's my next slide? Oh, yeah. I infuriated you guys by discussing the popular conception of a cherub versus the biblical conception of a cherub. And a cherub is not a baby angel, unfortunately. No, that is not a cherub. Neither is it a cute little grandson. That is not a cherub either. Okay? All right, now you're mad at me again, right? But this illustration is an artist's attempt to draw out what Ezekiel saw. And of course, we're dealing with the cherubim at the bottom of the vision here. Now, I don't have any problems with this image, because this detailed description that Ezekiel is giving to us, I believe God wants us to meditate on and try to figure out what Ezekiel's seeing. He tries to tell us in very specific terms what in the world he saw. So we left off last week on page 24 with the summary. We saw that there were four cherubim, four cherubs, and they formed a square. They all had four faces. The face of a man, the face of an ox, the face of an eagle, the face of a lion. And whenever you looked at, where, from whatever direction you looked at the divine chariot, you would see those faces. And that was basically, they had the wings touching each other, two wings covering their body. They had straight legs with hooves down here. So that is about as far as we got. He was describing the cherubs, all right? So now let's pick it up on page 25 of your outline. And we look at the actions of the cherubim. They weren't static. They moved around. All right, so we're at Ezekiel chapter 1. We'll look at verse 12. Everybody there? Okay, verse 12. And speaking of the cherubs, the cherubim, and each went straight forward. Wherever the Spirit was about to go, they would go without turning as they went. So there is movement here, but they all move, point Roman numeral 1, uniformly. These four beings are not independent. They're a unity, a compound unity to be sure, but a unity nonetheless. Totally coordinated. And that's the way God is, isn't he? He isn't haphazard. He just doesn't do things, and sometimes we go, well, as the Spirit moves, you know, just let it happen. Well, God just doesn't let it happen. He's a God of order. He's a God of coordination. Everything in this world works according to his plan. From the farthest galaxy out there, this is an excuse. I should have done one of my galaxy pictures. You know, from the farthest galaxy out there that the Hubble can look at to the tiniest subatomic particle in quantum physics. All of it moves in an orderly way. All of it is under his control. Nothing is haphazard or out of his control. And so these beings are that way as well. And our life is that way as well. Sometimes it looks like our life is out of control, but God is not. God is never, never just lets us go. All right, point B. Where the Spirit was to go, they went. Now notice Roman numeral 1, not on the basis of their own will, but where the Spirit impelled them. Now point 2, the question has been asked by commentators, what is the Spirit referred to here? The word there is ruach, the Hebrew word, and like many Hebrew words, it has a wide range of meaning. It can mean breath, it can mean spirit, it can mean the Spirit of God, it can mean the Spirit of man. It can mean a breeze. You have to take it in context. Remember, context is king. You have to take the meaning in context. So it's not clear here, Roman numeral 2, if this refers to the Holy Spirit or the Spirit of life issuing from God. And it's probably the latter. Other passages will indicate this is probably the latter, that God's life is empowering or enlivening the cherubim, and then the cherubim are moving around at their own will. They're being obedient to God. Okay, point C. They turned not when they went. They had four faces, so they didn't need to turn. Point 2 there, the bottom of the page. Whichever direction they went, there was always a face, a man's face facing forward. So the man's face is the prominent face, and he's always facing forward. All righty. Page 26. Now, the morning class was very vocal, asked me all kinds of questions about this. And you know what my answer is going to be? Feel free to ask questions, but my answer is probably going to be, I haven't seen this, guys. I don't know. Ezekiel knows what he was seeing, but he's struggling. You're going to see him struggle to try and put it in human terms, in human language. So we just do our best, and like this artist has done, he's done a pretty good job of trying to render what Ezekiel saw, but we have to render it in our minds as best we can. God wants us to do that, or else he wouldn't give us the details. But you can ask questions, I'll do my best to answer, but I'll use a lot of words like apparently, it seems like, things like that. This is much bigger than us. All right, page 26. Their appearance as they went. So they move around. There's movement by the cherubim. And here, verse 13 describes what it looks like. In the midst of the living beings, there was something that looked like burning coals of fire. Notice that. Something. He doesn't know what it is. It's something that looks kind of like this, like burning coals of fire, like torches darting back and forth among the living beings. The fire was bright, and lightning was flashing from the fire. Okay, again, he sees this thing, again, not knowing what it is, just trying to describe it like burning coals of fire. Very intense, very bright. And our artist has tried to depict that in the midst of the cherubim. So here he has this fire in the midst of this square that the four cherubs form. Now, what could the fire speak of? Well, fire can speak of purification. Isaiah chapter 6, for example. Isaiah is receiving his call to prophetic office. And he says, "Oh Lord, I'm a man of unclean lips. I can't do this." And so one of the seraphim in the picture, in the experience, goes over to the coal on the altar, and he takes the coal off the altar and he touches his lips and says, "Your lips have been purified. You've been cleansed." And so there's an example of fire speaking of purification, Isaiah 6. And it can also speak of judgment. That's point C. And here, judgment is probably in view because Judah is disobedient. Judah is going to be judged. Remember that this first 24 chapters of Ezekiel take place when Jerusalem is facing the Babylonians for the final destruction of Jerusalem. And the last chapters of Jeremiah overlap with the first chapters of Ezekiel. So judgment will come upon Judah from out of the north. Now, one other thought here. Judgment can also be a means of purification. So maybe both ideas could be summed up in this fire. And judgment as a means of purification could be seen in the idea of purifying silver or gold. You know, you put it in the fire, you melt it, the dross comes to the surface, you skim it off. And now through the fire of judgment, the silver is purified. So both ideas may be very valid here. Now, Roman numeral number 2, the appearance of the torches. Now, point A, torches are a symbol of the Shekinah glory, as in Genesis 15:17. Now, in Genesis 15, God signs and seals the Abrahamic covenant. He introduces the Abrahamic covenant in Genesis 12, but he signs and seals it in Genesis 15. And so he tells Abraham to go through the typical signing ceremony of the ancient Near East in those days. And if you were making a contract with somebody, you would take an animal or a number of animals, sacrifice them, cut them in two, and lay them out with a path between them. And then the two of you would walk between the animals. And you were saying, "May what happened to these animals happen to me if I break my part of the agreement." We do it a little simpler these days with a notary and a signature, you know. We'll take you to court if you break your part of the agreement. But here you were saying something similar. I will keep my part of the agreement. So here Abraham has done that. And he's in Genesis 15, it says he chases away the birds of prey. Then in verse 17, Genesis 15:17, it came about when the sun had set that it was very dark. And by the way, Abraham is put into a deep sleep here, we read in other verses. "And behold, there appeared a smoking oven and a" what? "A flaming torch which passed between the pieces." And here's an illustration of that. Of course, the flaming torch here being a symbol of the Shekinah glory. Two forms of the Shekinah glory, the visible manifestation of God's presence, appear to Abraham and move through the pieces. So God is saying, "Abraham, this covenant depends on me. It doesn't depend on you for fulfillment. Abraham didn't walk between the pieces. It depends on me. This is an unconditional covenant." And it's interesting to note that these two manifestations of the Shekinah glory are the two manifestations that led us out of Egypt, aren't they? When we came out of Egypt during the day, the Shekinah glory would look like a cloud of fire, and at night it was a cloud of fire, burning bright cloud, leading us out of Egypt. Okay, so there it is, a symbol of the Shekinah glory. So again, another symbol of the Shekinah glory in this vision of Ezekiel. Point C, fire went up and down among the living creatures. And so we have this extremely bright light, fire-like light moving around there, and then lightning, Roman numeral 2, out of the fire, lightning. So it must have been quite an incredible scene, all this flashing and movement and brightness. And again, these are all symbols of God's glory. For example, Exodus 20:18. And we have 20:18 up on the screen. This is when we're gathered at the base of Mount Sinai to receive the law. All the people perceived the thunder and the lightning flashes and the sound of the trumpet and the mountain smoking. And when the people saw it, all these manifestations of the Shekinah glory, they trembled and stood at a distance. So it was quite an amazing experience when we received the law as well. But again, very similar manifestations. God is showing us that he is no casual being. We can't trifle with him. He is great and glorious. Okay, so when the cherubim move, that's what you get. And of course, our artist has not been able to depict that. I don't know how you depict that. All right, the speed in which the cherubim move. Verse 14. And the living beings ran to and fro like bolts of lightning. So they are in motion, and they are moving very quickly, constantly in motion. So the only way he can describe it is like a flash of lightning. That's the best he can do. Then at the very bottom of the page, these beings have been called the living beings up till now. When we get to Ezekiel chapter 10, verse 20, oops, there's Mount Sinai. Sorry, I didn't show you that slide. There we are at the base of Mount Sinai, the thunder, the lightning, the cloud, all that. Ezekiel 10:20, we'll get this very clear statement. Ezekiel will see this vision again, and he will say, "These are the living beings that I saw beneath the God of Israel by the river Chebar." That's what they've been called up to this point, living beings. "So I knew that they were cherubim," they were the cherubs. There's a number of orders of angels. There's the cherubim, the cherubs, there's the seraphim, the seraphs, there's regular, what we call, I would guess called angels that appear in human form. There's a number of orders of angels. Whether I get into that or not, I don't know. But these are one of the orders of the angels, the cherubim. So we very clearly know what these beings are from Ezekiel chapter 10, verse 20, angelic beings. All right, any questions there? All right, that finishes up our look at the four beings, the cherubs. We turn to page 27, and we take a look at the four wheels. I won't show you the illustration again until we get through this section. But there are four wheels associated with the cherubs, and you've seen them in the illustration. Now they're described. Verse 15 begins the description of these four wheels. "Now as I looked at the living beings, behold, there was one wheel on the earth beside the living beings for each of the four of them. So we have, as he's looking at these cherubs, he notes these wheels, one wheel associated with each cherub. That's Roman numeral number 1. And the wheels are apparently what made contact with planet Earth. Somehow they're located somehow between the cherubs and the earth. They apparently are the contact point. That's why the rabbis call this the divine chariot, because of these wheels, we're creating what they would call a chariot. And point C there. He saw four wheels, associated with each cherub. Okay, now the makeup. Point 2 there, verse 16, the makeup of the wheels. He goes into more detail. "The appearance of the wheels and their workmanship was like sparkling beryl, and all four of them had the same form, their appearance and workmanship being as if one wheel were within another." Okay, beryl, that's the question I have up front here, and I will answer that for you. It's also known as point 2 there, chrysolite. For us, it's probably known as topaz, and here is a topaz here. Okay, there's a semi-precious gemstone, a topaz. It's either a gemstone or a crystal, I'm not sure, maybe. I'm not an expert in geology or anything like that. But the topaz can come in various different colors. It can come in blue like this. This is probably what Ezekiel saw. But it can also be yellow or brown or clear or pink. Here's another. It's a picture of topaz in an amethyst crystal, I guess is what it is. Got this off the web. So there's a clear one. So kind of a semi-transparent, semi-precious stone, probably of the blue color. So all of the wheels had this topaz-like appearance to them. All right, probably blue. All right, and probably a little bit transparent. Chapter, page 28. Page 28. Point C at the top of the page. Their appearance and their work was, as it were, a wheel within a wheel. And Dr. Fruchtenbaum has provided us with two little explanations there. We'll just read these. As if, well, here, let me put the illustration back up. Here's your wheels. You see them down here? 1, 2, 3, and 4 back over there. All right, let's look at Roman numeral 1. As if in the wheel there was a second wheel inserted at right angles so that without turning, now, I'm not rotating. They would rotate. Apparently, they would rotate. But by turning, you know, like your front wheels turn in your car, so that without turning, they could go in all four directions. Roman numeral number 2. Another description. Each wheel consisted of two wheels which bisected each other at right angles, allowing movement in the four directions without being turned. So that's what most commentators feel these wheels look like, and you can see them there, you know, right angles to each other. Each wheel pointing in a parallel direction with the face. So if you go in one direction, they don't have to turn. Come this way, they don't have to turn. They rotate, but they don't turn. Okay, does that make sense there? Let's see. Say again? Pretty, huh? Any kind? Well, by turning, when you have a wheel in your car, you turn it this way and you go around the corner. These wheels didn't do that. They rotated, but they went that way or this way. They didn't turn the way a carriage wheel turns or a car wheel turns. I'm trying to differentiate between rotating, which wheels and tires all rotate. Your back wheels don't turn on your car. They rotate, but they don't turn unless you've got a pretty fancy car. There are some cars that the back wheels turn. You see the difference what I'm trying to say here? They rotated, but they didn't turn. There was no need to do that. Okay? Question. It appears that, yeah, whichever direction they went, a man's face was leading. That's the prominent face. That appears to be the case. Okay? So they didn't, apparently when they made movement, they didn't curve. They, you know, they were digital. And people in the morning class said, that sounds like a gyroscope to me. Well, okay, kind of. Not exactly, but that appears to be the idea here. We're doing our best to understand what Ezekiel is trying to communicate with us, and he's doing his best here, believe me. All right, any other questions or comments there? Question?
Now, we're saying that these wheels touching the earth, so this is not a vision. He's seeing in heaven.
Well, these had the storm cloud come down from the north, and the midst of the storm cloud is that, and it apparently touches the earth, yes, apparently comes down and is very close to the earth or touches the earth, something like that. Again, apparently. We'll have to ask Ezekiel, or maybe the questions may all be answered when we see this. Okay, oh, okay, no wonder. Okay, now I understand. In a sense, yes, they are united, and yet it's a compound unity here. They are independent and yet united at the same time. They are called the four beings, and they are called the living being. They're spoken of in singular and plural terms, in both. Kind of like the word echad. The word echad in the Shema, for example, means compound unity. For example, in Genesis, in the beginning of Genesis, man and woman are married and they become basar echad, one flesh. So when you got married, you maintained your independence, man and woman, but when you experienced the marriage experience, you became one flesh. Okay, basar echad, compound unity. So that's the God is that way as well. These cherubs are that way as well, compound unity. Okay, that makes sense? Okay, don't feel bad if you're a little overwhelmed by all this stuff. Believe me, nobody on planet Earth has been able to figure this out, much less Ezekiel. He is doing his best. God wants us to understand, get a glimpse of who he is. He wants us to get a glimpse, but he is so far beyond us that it's tough for us to wrap our head around all this. And okay, shall we go on to the movement then of the wheels? Okay, good. Verse 17, the movement of the wheels. Wherever they moved, whenever they moved in any of their four directions without turning as they moved. So again, here's that repetition that I was talking about. The wheels crossed at right angles, so they didn't have to turn. They rotated, but they could go in all four directions without having to turn. North, south, east, west, however you want to say it. Okay? Verse 18. A more detailed look at the construction of these wheels. Verse 18. As for their rims, they were lofty and awesome, and the rims of all four of them were full of eyes round about. Okay. Point A, 4A. As for their rims, they were high and dreadful, and the Hebrew is very, very emphatic. As for their rims, height of them and fear of them. He's being very emphatic here. Now, I don't know how big this vision was. I get a feeling from this verse that Ezekiel's this little dot standing over here. And he's looking up, and he's seeing these wheels towering over him, the cherubim towering over him. That's the feeling I get out of this, that he sees himself as a little speck next to this thing. Remember, this thing came with this huge storm cloud. So he's very awed by what he's seeing here, by these wheels. And that's the lower part of the vision. Now, why were these wheels terrifying? Well, probably for their height, but also point B, the four had their rims full of eyes round about. Eyes on the wheels. And that's what all this decoration is on these wheels. These are eyes. All that. That's why the artist has drawn eyes on them. Now, the eyes emphasize the factor of God's omnipresence. In other words, God is everywhere. Okay? It also emphasizes his omniscience. God knows everything. God is always there, and he sees everything. He's always looking over your shoulder. No privacy policy with God, folks. You know, we can tell our insurance company or Visa or somebody, get out of my life. You know, I want to keep myself private. And here in America, we value our privacy. That's our right. No privacy policy with God, folks. He's not going to give you a little statement that says you can opt out. He's always there. He knows all that we do. Psalm 134, he knows the words we speak before we speak them. So when we begin to understand that this incredible being that we know personally also knows us right down to the very depths of our soul, our little sin-laden soul, we begin to get an appreciation of his love and patience for us. You know, we are just blades of grass. We are just broken potsherds, aren't we? It's all we are, dust. That's what the psalm says, that mankind is but dust, and yet we're beloved grains of dust, aren't we? Yes, Kelly. No, no.
I mean, he's actually seeing.
Yeah, he's seeing this thing. There's no indication that he's been put into a trance. He sees this storm cloud coming out of the north. Yeah.
With his conscience,
you know, describing the dreadful eyes full of wheels, creatures with four heads. I mean, all of this is like he knows. He's conscious. Yeah, I would agree with you. I think he's very conscious here. And when we get to the end of this chapter, you'll see how he responds to all this. Okay? You'll see that he's very conscious of all this. Yeah. I agree with you. Okay? He's awestruck by all this. Okay, so remember, folks, we are just blades of grass, dust specks, but we're beloved dust specks, beloved shards. Modern man, especially 21st century America, we think we're so cool. We're going to the moon. We've sent an explorer to Mars. We're going to plumb the depths of the universe, but we're pretty puny. We're pretty puny. And, size isn't the important thing to God. As we think back to my comments earlier, we're on this privileged little dust speck in the middle of the universe, privileged planet. By the way, you should get that video or DVD if you can. But size doesn't matter to God, So the Earth is this little dust speck that's barely visible, or invisible. What's happening here is of a momentous importance, okay? And your life is the same way. Even though we are just little dust specks, every life in this room, every life is important to him, okay? And he can do great things with each life in this room, with all of us. So if we have a feeling that we're unimportant, or how can God love me? I'm just this little sinful dust speck. Well, no, he does. You're a lot bigger than a subatomic particle. You're a lot smaller than a universe, but you're a lot bigger than a subatomic particle. So you're actually in the middle. You're actually somewhere in the middle. All right. All right, so these eyes, God knows and sees everything. We can't hide anything from him. We shouldn't try to. We do try to, like little kids, holding that chocolate bar. Whoop, they put it behind their back. There's chocolate all over their face, and turn around, trying to hide something. Well, we're like that. God is like our parent. He knows what's going on. Okay, let's take a look at page 29. The timing of the movement of these wheels. Verse 19. Whenever the living beings moved, the wheels moved with them. And whenever the living beings rose from the earth, the wheels rose also. So here we see point C, I think is your key. Parentheses C there. The wheels are not independent of the cherubs. They are coordinated right with them. And we see that is emphasized in verse 20, the basis of their movement, verse 20. Wherever the Spirit was about to go, they would go in that direction. And the wheels rose close beside them, for the Spirit of the living beings was in the wheels. So these wheels apparently touch the earth, and they rise when the divine chariot moves. And the basis for this movement is the Spirit of the living creature in the wheels. So this seems to be some kind of a delegated authority here, like God is enlivening the angels, as he does every creature, but then he's given them delegated power to control these wheels. God likes to work through delegation. He works through very orderly processes. He delegated to us what? He delegated to us the Great Commission. Talk about delegation. He sure could have done it a lot better himself. But he chooses to use believers. Don't ask me why, but he likes to use his creation. He likes to do that. So point D, we'll finish up and then have our break. Point D, parentheses D, their motions and rests, in their motions and rests, the wheels were completely bound by the movement of the rest of the creatures. Because the Spirit which ruled in them, the creatures, was also in the wheels, regulating their going, standings, and rising. So the Spirit there is probably the Spirit of life in the creatures themselves. But these wheels are attached to them somehow, not by A-arms and axles and bearings and all that kind of stuff we use in our cars today, but they're somehow spiritually attached to them and moving with them. And we'll see that in verse 21. When we come back from the break. It's 7:45, so go ahead and take your break and listen for the shofar, and we'll pick it up at the bottom of the page in verse 21. All right, let's pick it up. On the bottom of page 29, we've looked at the wheels, their construction, their action, the basis of their movement, and now the uniformity of their movement is emphasized in verse 21. Whenever those went, these went. And whenever those stood still, these stood still. And whenever those rose from the earth, the wheels rose close beside them, for the spirit of the living beings was in the wheels. And again, a repetition. Point D at the bottom of the page gives the reason for this uniformity, this repetition, this compound unity, this coordination that's going on between the cherubs and the wheels. The spirit of the living creatures was in the wheels. So they're spiritually controlled. They're not physically controlled the way we would think of wheels. And this is a totally different plane. This is totally different than what we're used to. So don't feel bad if you're feeling a bit overwhelmed and a bit confused and a bit, what does this mean to me? We'll talk about this in a little while at the end of the class, I believe, how this, what this can mean to you. All right, page 30. We have a little summary. And Ezekiel has described the lower parts of the vision. So he's stayed down here, right? The lower parts of the vision. And we will see in the upcoming section that the deity is carried aloft on a platform supported by four representatives of his creation. The wheels move. I think what he means, rotate, but the creature stands still. I believe he's trying to communicate that the wheels rotate as there's some movement here. And point C, yet the platform speeds lightly over the earth in whatever direction or spirit or impulse directs. So that's kind of a summary of the bottom part of the vision. Now, he's going to raise his eyes, raise our eyes, and begin to describe the upper part, the part above the cherubs. So point three, the firmament, the appearance of the firmament, verse 22. Now, over the heads of the living beings, there was something like an expanse, like the awesome gleam of crystal spread out over their heads. Now, point parentheses A. Notice that it says the head of the living creature, singular. The NISB, which I just read to you, translated that in the plural. That's not the best translation by the NISB. This is a singular Hebrew word, emphasizing point Roman numeral 2, that the four creatures comprise a unity. They are spoken of in the singular and in the plural. This is where they are spoken of as a living creature. Now, parentheses B, there was the likeness of a firmament. The Hebrew word there is rakia. It's the same word used in the creation story. And the root of this word means a hammered out piece of metal. So that begins to give us the idea of what it looks like. And it's some kind of a platform over the cherubs, point three. All right, page 31. The description of this firmament continues. Parentheses C, like the terrible crystal to look upon. And point Roman numeral 1, the Hebrew word there is ice. It's like ice. This firmament resembles a sheet of ice somehow. Maybe in the fact that it's partly transparent. You know how you freeze water? It's partly transparent. It maybe glitters. We don't know. We'll understand when we see it ourselves. Someday we will see it. But he's struggling to describe it. Now he describes it as, the Hebrew word there is nora, terrible, nora. Now terrible is an okay translation of that word, but that word tends to mean more like awe-inspiring. Think of the word terrible in the sense of awe-inspiring or awesome. Now, awesome is a word we throw around too much these days, but it's a good word. Now, that word shows up in other descriptions. For example, Judges 13:6, we have the experience of Manoah and his wife. These are the parents of Samson. And we read in Judges 13:6, then the woman, this is Manoah's wife, came and told her husband, saying, a man of God came to me, and his appearance was like the appearance of the angel of God. Very awesome. Or some translations, very terrible. But very awesome would be a better translation there. And I did not ask him where he came from, nor did he tell me his name. In other words, there's some people you don't ask questions about. And I didn't ask questions of this guy. No way. When I saw this guy, I just shut my mouth. I accepted him for what he was. Okay, so his appearance is very awesome. This is the angel of the Lord, by the way. And that would be a pre-incarnate manifestation of Yeshua, theophany, before he was incarnate. Job 37:22 has a very similar description. Same word is being used. Out of the north comes golden splendor, chashmal, you know, that amber color, that golden amber splendor. You're seeing the same thing here. Around God is awesome majesty. Well, that can summarize very much what Ezekiel is seeing. So that's the idea here. He describes this firmament as awesome, awe-inspiring. So points E at the bottom of that section, parentheses E, it looks like a platform gleaming dreadfully like ice spread over the heads of the cherubs. It's the best we can do. Now, as we move back to our illustration, we now move on to another aspect of the vision, and it's the wings and their relationship to the firmament in verse 23, the wings of the cherubs. Verse 23. Under the expanse, their wings were stretched out straight, one toward the other. Each one also had two wings covering his body on the one side and on the other. Now, God wants us to understand these details, otherwise he wouldn't tell us these details. So point Roman numeral 2 regarding the position of the wings. The upper wings are stretched out horizontally, and they appear to support the canopy, and you see the artist has drawn that here on our illustration. They're up close to the canopy. But point C, Roman numeral 1, at the bottom of the page, we will find out in just a little bit that the upper wings were moved. They were used for mobility, flying. So they did not actually support the canopy, but they touched it. They actually didn't support it. And then again, the lower wings, they emphasize, covers the body of the cherubs, again, probably humility before God. So our artist has tried to emphasize that by having these wings covering the bodies of the cherubs. Okay, does that make sense then? All right. No? No, but yes. That's fine. Fine answer. This is way beyond us. God is not like us. God is not like us. All right, page 32. Now, the action of the wings. There's noise when they move. Verse 24. I also heard the sound of their wings, like the sound of abundant waters as they went, like the voice of the Almighty, a sound of tumult, like the sound of an army camp. Whenever they stood still, they dropped their wings. So now he gives three descriptions of the noise he hears when these wings move. And this whole vision moves around. Three descriptions of the motion. B, Roman numeral 1, like the noise of great waters, a mighty torrent. So I pulled in this waterfall picture. Imagine yourself standing on those rocks and the noise that you would hear, the rumble that you would hear. Also, if I could find one, which I couldn't, water crashing through a wadi in Israel. If you're near a wadi, a dry riverbed, and the water comes thundering down it from the mountains, carrying rocks and trees and mud with it, you would hear this rumbling, awesome rumbling sound as well. I wish I could find a picture that would depict that. Best I could do is use this waterfall. So imagine the waterfall sound. The second picture he uses, trying to describe to the best of his ability what he hears, is Roman numeral 2, like the voice of the Almighty, and that would be rolling thunder. Often the voice of the Almighty is attached to rolling thunder. For example, here's a picture of a thunderstorm out in the, I think it's in the South Pacific. Now, if you're out near that thing, you would hear the thunder rolling across the sky. and in Exodus chapter 19 at the base of Mount Sinai, similar kind of sounds were heard. And it came about on the third day when it was morning that there was thunder and lightning flashes and a thick cloud upon the mountain and a loud trumpet sound, so that all the people who were in the camp trembled. And Moses brought the people out of the camp to meet God, and they stood at the foot of the mountain. So this is no ordinary thundering sound. These people wouldn't be terrified by normal thunder. This is something much more extensive, much more awesome and terrible in noise. And then his third description, again, as he tries to communicate it to us, Roman numeral 3, a voice of tumult like the noise of a host. And the explanation is very clear there. This is like the sound of an army on the move. And Ezekiel knew what that sounded like because he was taken into exile by the Babylonian army. And as he was marching along with them over the top of the Fertile Crescent, he heard them and he heard the rumbling of all the wagons carrying the supplies, all the soldiers clanking with their armor, all the equipment. And when we read studied the book of Jeremiah last year, we got a glimpse of this as well, because the people of Jerusalem heard the approaching Babylonian army, didn't they? Remember? They heard the sound of the moving army way before they saw it. And Ezekiel understood that as well. So we have this loud, loud, thunderous, rumbling noise when the wings move. But notice point C, parentheses C there. When they stood, they let down their wings. And the implication here is that things got quiet when they stopped the movement of the wings. It got quiet enough for Ezekiel to hear and understand the voice. And that brings us to verse 25. And there came a voice from above the expanse that was over their heads. Whenever they stood still, they dropped their wings. And again, here we have the connection with the wings movement stopping. Again, the implication of quiet silence so he can hear this voice. What this voice says to him will be made very clear in chapter 2. When we start into that next week, we'll hear what the voice says to him. But now with a description of the firmament behind him, he now directs our eyes further up. We now go from the firmament, which the artist has tried to present in this location. Now we go up to what is above the firmament. And what is above it but the glory of God? Verses 26 through the middle of verse 28. So we begin with the throne in verse 26. Now above the expanse that was over their heads, there was something, he doesn't know what it is, something resembling a throne, like lapis lazuli in appearance. And on that which resembled a throne, high up, was a figure with the appearance of a man. So again, I get from this description that he's looking way up there, that he's pretty tiny. And he's just a little speck at the bottom of this divine chariot. And looking way up there, he sees this thing that the best thing he can describe it as is a throne. And point two, it says it looks like a sapphire, lapis lazuli, or turquoise, in other words. It's apparently a turquoise color, like these turquoise rocks here, this kind of greenish-blue color. And so our artist has drawn a bluish throne-like thing up there. And then the important point is that on this throne there's a human-like appearance, a man-like figure. And the importance is found in point four. This is God appearing in the form of a man. This is a theophany. This is a visible manifestation of God's presence. He can choose to visibly manifest himself to us in any way he wants. Smoke, torch, fire, light, whatever he chooses. Here he chooses the form of a man. And that is reiterated in Psalm 18:10, but also in Daniel 7:9. Write down Daniel 7:9 beside Psalm 18:10 there. Because Daniel saw this same thing. Daniel saw the same thing. Daniel 7:9. I kept looking. He's looking and he says, until thrones were set up. So here we have something that looks like a throne again. And the Ancient of Days, that's a reference to God the Father, took his seat. So here we have a man-like appearance. His vesture, his clothes were white like snow, and the hair of his head was pure wool, like pure wool. His throne was what? Ablaze with flames. And its wheels, there we are, its wheels were a burning fire. He's seeing the same thing, isn't he? Ezekiel's describing it in detail to us, but Daniel is seeing the same divine chariot, isn't he? And once you're familiar with this vision of Ezekiel, this will pop up all over the place. They all saw the same thing, yes?
So is the Ancient of Days Jesus?
No, the Ancient of Days here is God the Father.
And yet now, because he's Spirit, this often
confuses. This is a visible manifestation of God. This is a theophany. He can choose at any time and in any way to reveal himself visibly to us. Okay? This is what he's doing here. He's visibly appearing.
I thought a theophany was Jesus.
No, no. Well, it is many times. This happens to be God the Father. Later on in this chapter, you'll see the one like a son of man comes to the Ancient of Days and receives the power and glory in the kingdom. That's Yeshua. That's God the Son.
Okay. And how does that line up with no man has seen God?
Well, no man has seen God in his pure essence, but he does choose to reveal himself visibly to us through the Shekinah glory, through theophanies, smoke, fire, torch, the burning bush, the cloud of, you know, all that stuff, the cloud of fire, etc. And he can do it in a man-like form as well, and an angelic-like form. And of course, when Yeshua appears as the angel of the Lord, that's a pre-incarnate visible manifestation of the second person of the Trinity. So God can do this. You know, this is a little bit beyond us as human beings. We're limited by the space-time continuum. But this is God the Father revealing himself to Daniel. Okay? Question.
Well, yeah, notice how God is, in the way Ezekiel sees this, is always compared to some element, like, you know, fire, mm-hmm. or snow or wool or something that's visible to us here on earth that we know.
Right.
So we can make some kind of we can grasp something.
Right. God wants through Ezekiel to help us grasp what he's like.
And his wheels, I keep thinking this mobility of these wheels, it's almost like God is just, wheels can go anywhere. It's just incredible how this is something beyond our understanding. But
right.
It's interesting how people say, well, you know, his power is manifest in this creation, and all these elements are here. Like we're like stardust. Mm-hmm. Elements, we go back to the elements, but from these elements come this beauty. It's almost like a mirror image of a hint of his glory.
Sure, yeah. This is just a hint of his glory, yeah. And we will see the real thing when we are glorified ourselves, yeah. So we'll understand this in by and by. We'll understand all this, but yeah. But again, God is not like us. He's far beyond us. Okay. All right, let's continue on here. Point B, he now hones in on this man, this appearance of a man on the throne, this description of a man. He wants us to understand that this looks like a man, but it ain't a man. All right, verse 27 and the first part of verse 28. Then I noticed from the appearance of his loins and upward something like glowing metal that looked like fire all around within it. And from the appearance of his loins and downward, I saw something like fire. And there was a radiance about him, As the appearance of the rainbow in the clouds on a rainy day, so is the appearance of the surrounding radiance. All right, the man on the throne, point one there. I saw, as it were, glowing metal. This is the chashmal again, the glow of God, the amber glow of God. So from his waist, his loins, his hips upward, he looks like glowing metal. Now, I haven't seen anybody with a complexion like that in my life, you guys. I don't care how many hours you spent out in the California sun with suntan lotion. You don't look like that. And then the appearance of fire, point 2C, from his waist, from his hips downward, he appears to be on fire. And here's what our artist is trying to do. See the glowing amber chashmal above, the fire below, right there at his loins, at his hips. He's trying to depict what Ezekiel is talking about. And there was a point four. There's the brightness around him. And again, here the artist has drawn a brightness around this figure, like a rainbow. Anyway, it was very awe-inspiring. And someone else that we're very familiar with saw this same individual. And that individual was John in Revelation chapter 1, verses 12 through 16. John also hears an incredibly rumbling sound, doesn't he, in the book of Revelation? And I turned around to see the voice that was speaking with me. And having turned, I saw seven golden lampstands. And in the middle of the lampstands, I saw what? One like a son of man. This guy looks like a man, but he ain't no man. I saw one like a son of man, clothed in a robe reaching to the feet and girded across his chest with a golden sash. His head and his hair were white like wool, like snow, and his eyes were like a flame of fire. Now here we go. His feet were like burnished bronze when it has been made to glow in a furnace. That's that amber chashmal glow, that glowing metal idea that's at the top of the figure. And his voice was like the sound of many waters. In his right hand he held seven stars, and out of his mouth came a sharp two-edged sword, and his face was like the sun shining in his strength. And there's that glow that Ezekiel sees. So again, there's no direct quotation of any of Ezekiel in the New Testament, but when you get into Revelation, if you're familiar with Ezekiel, you instantly see, I know where that came from. You read the book of Revelation and you know what he's talking about. You go right back to Ezekiel. And this is why there's so many off-the-wall interpretations of the book of Revelation. Because in my opinion, many, many commentators do not integrate the prophets into the book of Revelation. They either don't want to or they don't seem to be familiar enough with the prophets. But the book of Revelation is based on the prophets. The writer of the book of Revelation, John, expected the reader to be fully immersed in the prophets. The book of Revelation is not a detailed explanation of the tribulation period, but it is a chronological time frame. It's like a skeleton with ribs. And there's hundreds of allusions in the book of Revelation back to the prophets. And if you know the allusion, then you can put the data in the right place in the time frame. You go along, you say, oh, okay, let's see, that comes from Ezekiel, and that goes right there. You move along to the next sentence, oh, it comes from Daniel, and that goes right there. Oh, that comes from this prophet, and that goes right there. And when you do that, the book of Revelation becomes very, very straightforward. Because that's the origin. The origin of the book of Revelation is the prophets. So again, I recommend the Footsteps of the Messiah over there, Dr. Fruchtenbaum. That's the way he has approached the book of Revelation. That is the best book on eschatology, prophecy, and Revelation that I've read. And, you know, I read some of the, quote, classics, but you have to be immersed in something like Ezekiel. And I think you're beginning to see it now, because all of a sudden you're going to say, I know where that came from, and it's because God wanted to detail it for us through Ezekiel. All righty. Let's see. That finishes up page 33. Let's go on to page 34. And we will get through chapter 1 here. We'll get through page 34. And then we'll pick it up on chapter 2 next week. All right, let's finish it up here. The middle part of verse 28. Such was the appearance of the likeness of the glory of the Lord. Notice very clearly he tells us what he's looking at. This is the Shekinah glory. This is not a spaceship. This is the glory of the Lord. This is a, say again? Did I hear somebody? No? Okay. You know. All right. This is very clearly the glory of God. Now this vision, point two, will be repeated three times in the book. Chapter 3, during the predictions of the siege of Jerusalem. That's that judgment idea. Chapter 8, this will appear in regard to predictions concerning the departure of the glory from the temple and from Jerusalem and Judah. And then in chapter 43, the great encouragement, the prediction of the return of the Shekinah glory to Judah, Jerusalem, and the temple. Now, point D. These verses gave the rabbis Excedrin headaches. It doesn't fit with their theology, okay? Rabbinic theology and biblical theology are two different things, guys. Rabbinic Judaism is not the religion of the Bible. It's the religion of the rabbi of the rabbinic writings, and you should know that. For example, Rashi, the very, very influential French exegete, Rabbi Shlomo ben Yitzhaki. What did he say about these verses? It is not allowed to reflect on this passage. Especially in his commentary, verse 27. Don't meditate on this. Stay away from this. Okay. Now, Rambam, another very influential rabbi, in his Guide to the Perplexed, tries to make as big a differentiation between God and what Ezekiel is seeing as possible. It is also noteworthy that the likeness of a man above the throne is divided, the upper part being like the color of chashmal, the glowing amber, the lower part like the appearance of fire. Now consider how the sages clearly stated that the divided likeness of man does not represent God, who is above the whole chariot, but it represents a part of creation. The prophet likewise says, "This was the appearance of the glory of the Lord," but the glory of the Lord is different from the Lord himself. All the figures in the vision refer to the glory of the Lord, to the chariot, and not to him who rides upon the chariot, for God cannot be compared to anything. Well, I must be sympathetic to him, but that's not what Ezekiel is stating to us here. And there are other experiences that Jewish people had that are very similar to Ezekiel's. For example, Exodus 24, verses 9 through 11. This is dealing with Moses and the elders of Israel. Exodus 24, 9 through 11. Then Moses went up with Aaron, Nadab, and Abihu, and 70 of the elders of Israel, and guess what? They saw the God of Israel. This is, again, a visible manifestation of God's presence. Under his feet, there appeared to be what? A pavement of sapphire as clear as the sky itself. We just looked at that, didn't we? Mm-hmm. All right? Yet he did not stretch out his hand against the nobles of the sons of Israel. And there are great warnings against that. And they saw God, and they ate and drank. So here we have these guys seeing the divine chariot again. And it's very clearly stated they saw God. So the rabbis don't like that kind of thing. For example, the Art Scroll Tanakh commentary on Ezekiel, page 87. Here's how they handle it, a little more sophisticated way. The word chashmal indicates that the essence of God cannot be anthropomorphically perceived and is a combination of chash and mal, meaning that it is best to be silent as to its implications. What are they meaning there? Chash, the word silent, and they take the mal and they try to connect it with the word milah, which means word. In other words, be quiet about this. Don't look into this. Be silent regarding the implications of this section of scripture. And then in the Talmud, Haggigah 2:1, or the Mishnah, the Maaseh Merkava should not be taught to anyone except he be wise and able to deduce knowledge through wisdom of his own. In other words, don't teach this section to anyone who hasn't been trained by the rabbis so that we can clue them in as to what the real meaning of it is. Why are they so afraid of that? Well, they're very afraid of offending God because they knew that the reason we went into exile into Babylon was because we broke the law. And that's where all the traditions came from. We've got to set up some kind of a fence around the law that'll keep us from breaking it so this will never happen again. And that's the traditions, the oral law, the Mishnah. And so they want to make God as distant and incorporeal as possible. So we don't do anything to offend him. That's basically the idea. Okay, let me finish up here because I got asked, what does all this mean to me? What does all this mean to me? Same question was asked in the morning class. Well, I hope that after this chapter, the following verses are going to take a new meaning to you. Colossians 2:9, for in him, Yeshua, all the fullness of deity dwells in bodily form. All this that Ezekiel saw is awe-inspiring and overwhelming to us. So what did God choose to do? I'm going to take all my fullness and I'm going to surround it by a human body, and I'm going to walk among them and talk with them and touch them and eat with them and suffer with them and get tired with them and die for them and be resurrected for them. And so all the fullness, all that we see in this vision was incorporated in the God-man Jesus the Messiah. And you know what happened on the Mount of Transfiguration? Yeshua allowed the Shekinah glory glow to penetrate through his body so that the disciples could see it. That's why it looked like he was so white and glowing. And then he veiled his glory once again. So you see, all that Ezekiel sees here is in Yeshua. And we all have a part of that. You know why? Because his Holy Spirit indwells every believer. You are a temple of the Holy Spirit. You are a temple, a part of that vision that Ezekiel saw. But next time you read this, think back to Ezekiel chapter 1. Also, Philippians 2:6-8. Yeshua, although he existed in the form of God, and we just saw him revealing himself to us in his glory in Ezekiel chapter 1, he did not regard equality with God a thing to be grasped, but what? He emptied himself. How did he empty himself? By taking on the form of a bondservant and being made in the likeness of men. And being found in appearance as a man, he humbled himself even more by becoming obedient to the point of death, even death on a cross. He entered, he indwelt a fully human body. God became a man, and he went through everything that we go through so that we would have a personal relationship with him, so that we wouldn't, like Ezekiel, feel like a little dot overwhelmed by this incredible glory, this incredible being. Does that make sense? Yes.
No, it really shows God's willingness, just like, take the Abrahamic covenant, as you mentioned, that God will not break his word or promise.
Right, he wouldn't make.
Total responsibility for the creation it's just a it's just amazing.
It's an overwhelming, the Bible is overwhelming in its depiction of God's love for us and what he is willing to do for his creation, for those that love him. And, if you love him, this is what he's willing to do for you. To take all that vision of, that's all that's contained in that vision, which is so far beyond us, and inhabit a human body, and then go through that humbling servant experience, that humbling death experience, that suffering experience for us. So I hope that brings it home to us today. Now, just on one more note, we're a little over time, but I want to close on this idea of a chariot. The rabbis call this the divine chariot. Well, you can see chariots all over in Israel these days, and there they are. That's not a modern Israeli chariot. That's the Merkava. That's the Merkava battle tank that the Israelis have put together. That's the same. That's the word, the chariot. So that's not exactly a divine chariot, but it is. Those things really rumble when they move around, too. If you want to hear the movement of a tumult of an army, then Here, the America Van, the move. All righty, so there's a human chariot, very different from a divine chariot. All right, let me close in prayer. We'll pick this up on chapter 2 next week, and we'll look at the reaction that Ezekiel has to all of this and what the voice has to say to him. All right, let me close in prayer. Father, again, we want to thank you for this amazing chapter number 1 of the book of Ezekiel, far beyond us. Lord, if we can't wrap our minds around this, well, you want us to, but help us to wrap our minds around this and our hearts around this, because it's so hard. You are not like us. You are far beyond us. But help us to begin to understand your glory and your magnificence and your character and your love and your justice, everything that is you. And help us to understand it through Yeshua, too, because everything that is you resided in that human body, that God-man that we call Yeshua. And then when we begin to get a grasp on your great person and your great love and your incredible humility, then help us to pass that on to those around us, that we help it to change our lives, Lord, so we can do that delegated work that you gave us of the Great Commission to make disciples of all the nations, to the Jew first. So again, help us in our understanding of this, of who you are. And we ask this in Yeshua's name and for his sake. Amen. All right, we'll see you next week.